and stuff. Let's get on with the show. As we advertise, what we did last year, we did two shows that focused on the Naval Academy. We had one show with either present or recently graduated midshipmen, and another one with some of the professors at the Naval Academy. And what came out of these discussions was what it takes to educate a leader. And that props up on a regular basis on the intellectual side of a leader and where they come from, how they're educated, and what you can do to help inform this future leader as they grow into positions of responsibility. You know, because things change over time. Some things traditionally work. Environments change. Challenges change. So that discussion continually needs to go on. And we think we have two guests today that are really going to line us up well to discuss this. Our first guest is going to be Vice Admiral Michael H. Miller, United States Navy. He is the 61st Superintendent of the United States Naval Academy. And for the second half of the hour, we're going to have Dr. Victor Davis Hanson, a PhD. He is an author, professor, syndicated columnist. He's also the Martin and Illy Anderson Senior Fellow in Residence in Classics and Military History at the Hoover Institute over in Stanford University. But let's get on straight with our first guest, Vice Admiral Miller. Welcome to MidRats.
Thanks, Sal. Thanks, Eagle. It's great to be with y'all.
And it's a beautiful day here in most of the country. I know you're having a little bit of drizzle there, so we'll keep you inside for a bit. And just a lot of our listeners, they're not very familiar with the Naval Academy. They've seen the pictures. They've probably seen them on the football game, on a trifold, but they didn't go there. They've been interested in other things. So if you could, just take a minute and outline for the listeners, what is the mission of the Naval Academy? And as the superintendent there, what is your role there?
Well, Sal, we actually have a pretty clear mission statement, as I know you're familiar with. It's to develop our midshipmen, those are the students that come and join us here at the Naval Academy, to develop them morally, mentally, and physically, and to imbue them with the highest ideals of duty, honor, and loyalty in order to graduate leaders who are dedicated to a career of naval service and have potential for future development in mind and character to assume the highest responsibilities of command, citizenship, and government. Now, that's a charter for the school. I think that's really important. You see it in a lot of the classrooms and that sort of business here on the campus. But translated into real terms, it's taking folks that most of whom do not come from a military background, to giving them a very concentrated four-year education here on the banks of the Severn River, beautiful Annapolis, and giving them this military motif to this education that embraces both a more traditional technical education as well as the military arts that will prepare them for service in the Navy or the Marine Corps.
Well, Admiral, over the years, the educational goals of the Academy seem to have the focus of the Academy seems to have shifted. As I recall, there was a period when most Academy graduates ended up with engineering degrees of some sort, and now there seems to be a broader diversity of degrees. But what kind of forces drive the process of deciding what curriculum items should be included for an Academy graduate and the choices they're allowed to make? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yes. In point of fact, you're exactly right. Prior to 1968, everybody took the exact same courses, and they had, they marched to class, and it was what one would have to consider a cookie-cutter approach. What we have embraced here subsequent to that, and quite frankly, that was just being implemented when I got here. Everybody graduates with a Bachelor of Science, and that's because even if you're an English major, and we do have humanities and social sciences here, if you graduate with a humanities major, you still get a large portion. At least an English major would, for example, would get 37% of his or her education would still be technically based. And that's because of the technological sophistication of the fleet they're going to inherit. So 23 different degrees, And even though it may appear that since we now have officially blessed humanities, and of course we did that back in 1968, still the vast preponderance, 65 to 70% of the midshipmen are in technical majors, not necessarily engineering. And you have to remember that when you talk, people say, well, there's a, we, in fact, when we're graded, we're considered a liberal arts college, and that's because the maths and sciences are considered part of the liberal arts. MIT, for example, is an engineering school, and that's because more than 50% of their majors are actually officially titled engineering. Now, we have plenty of engineering here, as I know you both are aware, from aeronautical to naval architecture to you name it. I mean, it's still a very technically related school. And as I look at what we need to graduate for the future, I am a little concerned, not at the Naval Academy, but in the university system writ large, because I'm told that more than 50%, I think the number is now over 60% of our graduates now are in the humanities, and yet we look at how dependent we are on the technologies of today and how much more we will be dependent on the technologies of tomorrow. And I think that this is the kind of school where you are given that opportunity, both through the facilities and the faculty, to be able to focus on that distant horizon and get a very solid technical background here before you ever go out into the fleet or into, you know, quite frankly, business, if you decide not to stay in the Navy or the Marine Corps, give you an opportunity to be able to excel there because the basics are so solidly put here.
That's a Vice Admiral Miller, that's a great lead in to one of the points that I wanted to bring up is we all have our own little prisons we look through. And I have a non-technical background, but like all people who went to the Academy ROTC, you're required to get your technical background regardless of what you want to specialize in, which works out well. But when you look at the Navy's experience in the last decade, in the war that we're in, it's in many ways, it's a war of ideas, it's a war of culture, it's a war that to really understand it, you need to have an understanding of history, philosophy, and probably a little bit of religion thrown in there as well in order to see the prism that your opponents are seeing the world through. Has the Naval Academy looked at the class structure that they have with their midshipmen and have tried to inject something that might be, for lack of a phrase, a little more relevant to some of the challenges that leaders have seen in the last decade compared to the real technical battles of the Cold War?
Well, I think we have. Now, here's kind of how I would put it. I mean, we spend a great deal of time both in and outside of class discussing the significant milestones in naval history, and I think you have to have that. I don't. If you're going to be an officer in the Navy or the Marine Corps, if you don't understand where you've come from, I think it's very difficult to figure out where you're headed. I think that's probably true in all walks of life, but particularly here. So that being said, as we have approached it in our curriculum, there's a balance. And so you say, well, okay, do we spend a great deal of time studying the classics? And I know you're going to have Dr. Hansen on, and I would expect that he would advocate for doing just so. I was over at St. John's yesterday for our annual croquet match. You talk about a school that is steeped in the classics. And I think ours is a balance between that classical dedication and the more modern technical schools that say, well, you know, perhaps you don't need to study the humanities as much. All you really need is to understand the ones and zeros. That being said, so I would offer that we are that. I think there's a natural tension there between these missions that I described, the moral, mental, and physical, because your academics similarly, there's a tension between the engineers and the mathematicians and the humanities, the military, the leadership courses that all of the midshipmen are required to take, and if you've done it right, all of that produces someone that can focus absorb those details, but then ultimately be able to perhaps not, you know, I think it's an immersive type school, so perhaps right at the time it may not all fit together. Many of the things that you mentioned, Sal, are policy type discussions that I think probably evolve as you are given these tools, a very solid toolbox to take with you into the fleet. And then you get out and you say, okay, all right, so now I start to see not just the two dimensions of a flat page in a book, but rather I get to see the rich context of naval history. Think about where our naval officers were just 100 years ago. I mean, they were respected around the world, and in fact, in many cases, were emissaries. 200 years ago, they were authorized to sign treaties and to negotiate. Because of the lack of communications, they were the United States of America when they pulled in. So I think if you have an appreciation for that, but at the same time are given a technical background with the humanities mixed. And so if you're an engineer, instead of, I mentioned the English major that would be taking 37% technical courses, if you're an engineer, you're probably taking around 80% technical courses. But you still, in that 20%, you're still getting that exposure that will give you, I think, a solid foundation to interact in a world that requires a great deal of interpersonal relationships, as we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan, and repeatedly wherever the Navy pulls in many cases, we are, our naval officers, and I'm very proud of the fact our Navy and Marine Corps officers, when they set foot on foreign soil, in many cases, they're the first Americans that these people may have seen.
Well, speaking of alien environments, so you mentioned croquet at St. John's. Were you having high tea on a croquet lawn, or were you actually talking about lacrosse? I know your women's team are doing well.
Well, in point of fact, we lost. I believe that makes us our overall record of 5-24 against the Johnnies. And, of course, this dates back to 83 when there was a challenge issued by the commandant to the Johnnies. And the Johnnies play lacrosse very well, but I would tell you yesterday was nothing but a great big garden party, and it was a lot of fun. And, of course, the women's lacrosse team did remarkable yesterday, playing up in Colgate. Colgate's home field advantage, and they had to come from 5 points down to be able to win that. And that, again, gets back to this physical mission that we have here at the Naval Academy, which is a little unique relative to the other universities, in that everybody here is there's a physical part of this. You're required to participate in sports, be they intramural or club or varsity. And our women's lacrosse team was just spectacular yesterday in displaying what I'd like to call the competitive edge. These are people that really want to believe to win, believe that they can win, and you see them out on the field and you go, good gracious, that's the kind of competitiveness that you need, because in the world that they will inherit, where they will serve, there are no points for second place. They must win, and they must go in knowing that they're going to win in future conflicts.
On a more serious note, Admiral, I have a question. Speaking of competitive events, how much pressure is on the Academy from the various communities, surface and the submarines and the aviation communities, to provide a curriculum to the MIDS that meets a need of that particular branch of the service? The engineering, judging from my son's ROTC applications, they were really adamant that he major in some technical field unless they had some great excuse not to. But, is that the same kind of pressure being brought on the Academy that I think they're feeling out in the ROTC world?
Oh, I think there's certainly that tension. Our submariners in particular need to have a very strong engineering background, and so we draw heavily from them. But that's not to say that we don't take humanities majors who have displayed the same sort of proclivity for the maths and sciences. But submariners in particular are expected to be very technically sound and solid. The Marines are not as focused on what the major is. They're really focused on a solid leader that has been sort of tested by fire, tempered by the heat of the Naval Academy. And similarly, the surface warfare world, the aviation world, our SEALs. We had a record number of SEALs this year, 30 SEALs. 14 went into explosive ordnance disposal. 10 doctors are coming out of the Naval Academy this year. And of course, I'm very proud. Our aviators come from every imaginable walk of life and every major. But I guess that's probably true for all of the folks that select here. So while there is an expectation that you have to be technologically sound, I would expect that what you've experienced with your son is similar here. The invitation to get in the door for the interview. They're looking at grades and saying, okay, so how did this person do in higher level math and sciences? Because there is an expectation, especially if you're going to nuclear power school or onto prototype before going into submarines, there is an expectation that you can take even higher level mathematics after you graduate in order to be able to successfully run and basically be licensed as a nuclear power plant operator.
And just to give you an indicator of success there, one of the guys up in the chat room, his son, Jeff Withington, Naval Academy graduate, let us know that the number two graduate in his nuke power school was an English major. So even for the non-technical majors, you're doing a good job preparing those people, as I'm sure you get the feedback from the fleet, that when they got a differential equation, they got to be able to plow through it to get to the fleet. The question I wanted to throw your way is, when people listen to your voice, you obviously don't fit the stereotype that a lot of civilians have, that the military is predominantly Southern. You have that nice North Dakota lilt to your accent. And that brings a question that you receive young men and women from throughout this country. You and I literally grew up on opposite parts of the country. Very different academic backgrounds, different school systems. You also have people coming from overseas. And the Naval Academy also has a very good institutional knowledge about the foundation, educational foundation that students have coming in, and even cultural foundations coming in, and what you want to produce on the other end. Have you had a chance to look and think about the young men and women that are coming to Annapolis now? What positive attributes are they bringing to the Academy that perhaps wasn't there 10, 20, 40 years ago, but even more as somebody who is chartered by the Navy to produce the best Navy Marine Corps leaders possible? Are there also some areas that are more of a challenge than perhaps the 30th superintendent had with his midshipmen in order to bring them through the program?
Well, part of it, it's a fascinating subject, and I think every university president or chancellor would tell you the very same thing. It all has to start with admissions, doesn't it? I mean, you have to first get the right clay, this high quality clay, before you can turn it into that extremely refined product of porcelain. And so, I've looked at it, and I think our big challenge is ensuring that we get the broad spectrum of Americans interested in the Naval Academy. By Title 10, we are geographically diverse. That means we take surfers from Hawaii and we take sailors from St. Thomas. We have Guamanians here, obviously proud territories in the United States and commonwealths that affiliate with us. So we've got Puerto Ricans here and we've got North Dakotans and we've got, you have to be able to appeal to all of those folks. Now, this year we crossed over 19,143, I think, people that submitted an application. And I don't know, that's a record for us, and I'm very proud of that fact, but that's not the fully qualified people. That's just the people that would like to come here. I think that's, while the number itself is not so significant, it's the slope, the trajectory of this particular, of our admissions program that continues to engage young, bright minds across the nation. And I think that the biggest challenge here is to ensure that we have gotten that word out. It's one of the reasons why I'm so pleased to spend time with you and Eagle today, is that this school thrives on the opportunity for young men and women from every state in the union. I mean, you think about that. I mean, that's part of our charter. So you get to meet the kid from the bayou, and your roommate might be from, you know, upstate New York, or it might be a farm kid like me from North Dakota, or some kind of sailor out of San Diego. And the more I have looked at it, and the more people I talk to, you come to realize, and I suppose it's so obvious that it doesn't need saying, but you learn as much from your peers as you do from your professors. And by having this dynamic student body, all of these folks sort of mixed into what is a very pressurized environment. And I tell all of the folks that are interested in coming here, don't come here if you're looking for an easy education. This is not an easy school. It's a very difficult school. And it's difficult in the sense that we have very high standards, and we take away a lot of your free time. So whereas in other schools you go, well, gee whiz, I'm really going to have to study on this. I think I'll just cut class for a couple days and focus on this one, and I'll pick up the rest of them. No, we actually, you have to go to school every day here, and you really do have to perform on all of those tests. And, oh, by the way, when school's over at the end of the day, you're going to go out and do some sort of athletic endeavor that's going to get you out of the dorms and get you out running around and working up a sweat. And then I'm pretty draconian about having people study in the evening, so we have study hours. So for a couple hours, you're going to be in your room and you're going to be studying. You're not going to be out, you know, going to the student union or what have you. So, but you know, for that, and I suppose that sounds a little bit constrictive, but it's a formula here that many years ago perhaps superintendents would have taken for granted. I look at it as it's an opportunity here to ensure that we give the midshipmen, our students, every opportunity to succeed. And in this school, as difficult as it is, if they're willing to work, if they're motivated, everybody can graduate from the Naval Academy. It's a very good school, but we've got professors that'll they stay every night as long as the mids need them. There's always people there that are willing to help because we all come to our own personal intellectual Waterloo, if you will, at some point in time in school. Certainly I did anyway. So.
Well, I think we've done a pretty good job about covering the academic aspect of the academy, and the topic, as we narrow down here in minutes, was directed to the other part of the education of our future combat leaders, which is exactly that. How do we teach, and what are you doing to teach these young people to be ready for those roles and missions as the young second lieutenant in charge of a Marine platoon or a combat pilot or a SWO on the deck of a ship engaged in action?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first and foremost, the school is about leadership. I would argue that if this isn't a four-year immersive laboratory in leadership, well, then you don't need a Naval Academy or a West Point or an Air Force Academy. It is about training people to be able to stand up and say, follow me, and to have the credibility and the wisdom, even at a young age, for others to have the trust in those that are put in leadership positions. And so we spend a great deal of time. We have the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership Development here, and that's an adjunct to the Naval Academy leadership and ethical leadership subsets that the midshipmen go through. So we spend a great deal of time talking about how do you communicate, how do you set your priorities, how do you ensure that you are an ethical leader? Because if you start from that foundation of ethical leadership, I think all things are possible. And it is the core of every successful organization. And I defy anybody to show me one where at the very foundation you don't have ethical leaders that have garnered the trust of those that they lead. Or for those successful organizations that are going to last and stand the test of the time. And that's certainly what we're about at the Naval Academy.
Well, along those lines, what is the purpose of sea trials? What is sea trials, and what's the function of sea trials?
Well, sea trials is for our freshmen at the end, trailing end, I guess really the last week of their freshman year here. And, of course, as you know, our freshman year is very demanding. We put our midshipmen together as freshman teams. The folks that they are, you know, the way the academy's organized are in companies, and so the freshmen from each of the companies then they've been studying and working out and marching together for an entire year, and then we put them through some pretty demanding physical exercises that test their ability to build the teams and to be able to take a little bit of water and some cold weather perhaps and everything from rappelling to swimming to paddling, being able to put together a plan and then execute it. There are metrics against every one of these various drills. It starts at like 4:30 in the morning and basically lasts an entire day. And at the end of it, it's a physically exhausting drill, but it's also, I think, mentally challenging for our midshipmen to have put together after a year here. Very, you know, very active, very mentally and physically active, and then say, okay, hey, here's this crucible. Can you put together a plan? And I mean, everybody is going to make it through it, but some are going to do better than others. And it's from those both great decisions they make and poor decisions that they make that they learn. I will tell you, me personally, I always go into something expecting that I'm going to win, but I have learned far more from my failures than I have from my successes, and that's what Sea Trials is kind of founded on.
Errol, we're coming up with just about a minute and a half left, been a very quick half hour. I'm kind of a self-professed book geek, and I know in the maritime services, two of our top five, I guess, active duty intellectuals, General Mattis and Admiral Stavridis come to mind, and they're great consumers of books. But if you had a young man or woman who was 18, 19 years old and was looking at going forward and serving their country for whether it's 4 years or 40, and you could put three or five books in their hands and say, go read these, what would those be for you?
If they don't have a lot of time, I'd say read John Huntsman's "Winners Never Cheat." It's about ethical leadership at the very grassroots. There's a great book by Daniel Pink called "Drive," and it talks about what motivates us, what gets our juices flowing. And then for a background, because I do believe in this historical perspective. The Long Road to Annapolis, and that's by William Lehman. That's a wonderful book. I think if you started there, and then I would tell you go on the link and go watch Marcus Buckingham talk about playing to people's strengths. In fact, I think we have a link to that, if I'm not mistaken, on the Naval Academy website. If it doesn't get you fired up, nothing will.
Beautiful. And Vice Admiral Miller, thank you very much for taking time this Sunday to spend a half an hour with Eagle One, myself, and our listeners. And hopefully we'll have an opportunity to have you back again, because I don't know about Eagle One, but I have about eight or nine other questions I wanted to ask you. It was a real enjoyable conversation.
Three more sheets, Admiral. Three more sheets.
Okay. Well, I look forward to the next opportunity. Thank you, gentlemen.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Out here.
And also, for everybody who might be new to MIDRATS, I am Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And this is MIDRATS. We just had on the 61st Superintendent of the Naval Academy, Vice Admiral Miller. And let's go ahead and reintroduce our second guest today, for those who joined us late. Our second guest will be Dr. Victor David Davis Hanson, PhD, author, professor, and nationally syndicated columnist. He's also the Martin and Ellie Anderson Senior Fellow in Residence in Classics and Military History at the Hoover Institute and Stanford University. And because I am the self-professed book geek, he also has a new book out called The Father of Us All, War and History, Ancient and Modern. Dr. Hanson, welcome to MIDRATS.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, sir. And just a little note for our listeners, it's not your line. We just have a little bit of a connection line, but that's okay for those old Navy types who are used to HF radio. This is a very good connection. Sir, What kicked things off? One of the discussions that we had in the previous half hour was with the superintendent of the Naval Academy, Admiral Miller, and you've spent a lot of time in academia. Both, I know you've had some people who have gone on to the careers in the military who have been your students, those who have gone into government. You're very active in discussions really throughout the strata in the national security area. And when we're looking at leaders, both academically and morally, if you have somebody who is looking on going into a career that requires leadership and combat, what are some of the characteristics you think of somebody like Vice Admiral Miller in a service academy? What should they look at, and once they get hold of these people, what are some of the core things they should make sure that these young men and women take on board?
Well, I think in any bureaucracy, university, military, government service, there's a tendency to reward conformity and uniformity, and that, especially when people are younger and they realize that complacency, obsequiousness, all of those traits in peacetime lead to promotion and success, but in wartime they're fatal. So what happens in war and during combat is a winnowing out process. And all of those who were failures in peace, people like Sherman, Patton, Grant, in that moment of war, they have particular what had been called eccentric traits or qualities, highly individualistic, highly opinionated, highly confident, that are essential. So it seems to me that what a superintendent or a commandant or a general or an admiral has to do, he's got to make leeway or at least give some realm to those in his midst that will be combat leaders, and with the expectation that they will not necessarily, on paper or through testing or through consensus, always be the top of the class or the top of the division in times of peace. So I think a good leader's really got to not only look for introspection within himself and to question consensus, but to be able to appreciate eccentricity in others as well, even if it's bothersome and uncouth.
That's an interesting point, Dr. Hansen. The question I have for you is that you have sounded, said before that among the things that military leaders should study, or potential military leaders should study, is the Peloponnesian War and some of the other classics. Why should they go back and study about the war between the Greeks and the Athenians and the Spartans?
Well, it would only be because of two reasons. One, that human nature is unchanged, and that improved diet or the use of electronic gadgetry or genetics have not changed human nature at all, or very, very little at all. So we are the same people. We have the same appetites. We react to the same stimuli as the Crusaders or Cortez or the Greeks or the Romans. And then two, that observers of human nature, in the past, people like Thucydides were as astute or as adroit in chronicling human nature as people are in the present. And I think both those happen to be true. In other words, we have the same stimuli the Greeks did, and we react in predictably routine fashion. And the people who noticed that in the past, in some ways, were more sensitive to it than we are today. So when you read Thucydides, and whether it's the Melian dialogue or the debate over Mitylene or the Corinthian debate at Sparta or Pericles' funeral oration, the themes are pretty basic. Why do states go to war? What is deterrence? What's balance of power? What's the role of honor, fear, pride in goading on a state that otherwise does not have economic interests? How do wars end? What brings them to an end? How do you create a lasting peace? Those are issues that a person can find and learn about very easily in a text like Thucydides.
Building right off that, I last year, and I hadn't done this since I was a teenager, and when I first read it, I just remember it bored me to death, probably because of the way it was taught to me. But I reread Xenophon's Anabasis, and here I was right after I had completed my naval career, and as I read in that 2,400-year-old story, when he describes the leadership characteristics of the major players in his operation, I saw in there the template of all the good leaders and the bad leaders that I experienced in my naval career. And it was just, none of this is really new. It always echoes. These personalities are the same. And when we had you coming on, I know you saw this in person. Back in the 1980s, back when I was in school, you had Jesse Jackson at Stanford in his Hey, Hey, Ho, Ho, Western Civ Has Got to Go, a hostility towards educating people on these truths that have been around for thousands of years. Has that really taken root in academia to the point that if we have future leaders, they really don't know what's come before, and so we find people repeating the same errors in the past?
Well, I think so. I think that debate was lost in the 80s, so that the therapeutic curriculum is now indoctrinated among most college students. You saw that with figures as diverse as General Tommy Franks and President Barack Obama. They both at one point in the last few years said that victory doesn't really exist anymore, that it's too complex in today's world. And of course, victory is an age-old concept of making your enemy through force of arms accept your political objectives. And it may be obscure to some people, but believe me, what went on in the Bekaa Valley or what goes on in Mogadishu is no different than the complexity that went on in Acarnania with the Athenians. And for every place that we think victory doesn't exist, whether it's in Libya or whether it's in Afghanistan, throughout history there's been theaters that are far more ambiguous, far more complex. There's leaders who are able to understand what victory was to achieve it. So I think that we have a real problem today because our foremost military and civilian leaders really have sort of been nursed on social science, anthropology, sociology, linguistics, social linguistics, etc., and they don't have any appreciation for the constancy of human nature. They really do believe that they are unique and that suddenly around, 1990, 2000, the world changed all of its rules just when it came of age. And that's absolutely not only absurd, but it's dangerous.
Well, part of the other thing that the academic world seems to have done is throw out military history courses and teach, I don't know what they teach, but in these departments of war, peace, and national defense or whatever it is, is there a benefit for them to reading things like Lee's Lieutenants and having a debate about whether Longstreet was a better general than some of the other generals there, and issues like that? Have we lost something by the loss of these departments in our major universities?
Oh, I think so, because education, is a zero-sum game. We keep adding to the menu of the curriculum, and we have these things called studies courses, ethnic studies, women's studies, leisure studies, environmental studies, community studies. We keep layering them on students, both in the general education core and then in the elective curricula. And it all comes at the expense of what? It came at the expense of philosophy, literature, history, particularly military history. And the result is that we have a certain arrogance and ignorance, and that's a lethal combination. Today's young people think they're very important, and they have certain exceptional notions about themselves. Mostly they think they're victims of some, cosmic oppression, but... And then at the same time, they're quite ignorant because nobody's given them the opportunity to learn military history or geography or just standard history and literature, so they don't have any frame of reference. So I'm speaking as someone who taught a quarter century and still does teach, And when I see today's students, I just have to assume they don't know anything of the common landscape of their own culture and heritage, specifically as it applies to military affairs. It used to be 25 years ago, if I said the Bald or Shiloh or Okinawa, they didn't know it. But they did know Normandy Beach, and they did know Gettysburg. Today, if I say Gettysburg, none of the undergraduates have a clue what it is. They have a clue that they're supposed to have a particularly correct answer. If I mention the Civil War, they'll say Harriet Tubman, Sterner Truth, or the Underground Railroad. But if I say, what was the March to the Sea, or what happened in May of 1864 when Grant went to Richmond and Sherman took off for Atlanta, they have no idea about any of that. It's a complete blank, and so they don't know any of the lessons from that. And the result is, you can see it in our collective hysteria, whether it was Iraq or Afghanistan or now Libya, people have nothing to compare it to. If I said to some person that we lost 800 soldiers in one day in November of 1950 during the retreat from the Yalu, nobody would know what you were talking about. All they know is that our losses in Afghanistan just have to be the worst and the most reckless and the most tragic in the history of human society. And I wish I could, I mean, I feel terrible about the cost, but compared to other wars, you get some sort of comparison. And that is completely lost. In fact, even to evoke those comparisons is somehow suspect, callous.
And I've noticed the same thing, and it's been around, and you've seen it in person. One of the data points that I like to use with people is right after 9/11 took place, I was in theater, and I found myself within 48 hours photocopying chapters and maps from Hopkirk's The Great Game, because I found with my junior officers, besides one or two, they had no idea of the geography of Central Asia, even the fact, you know, where does Pakistan fit in? Much less the former Soviet republics to the north. They had no idea why Afghanistan was shaped the way it was, or had any idea it even touched on Iran. Just amazing, not stupidity. These are very intelligent people. Just a maleducation. And because of that, oftentimes you just have to make do with what you do. And I wanted to kind of ask you a question that I ask at the very end of our visit with Vice Admiral Miller, is besides obviously your canon of books, I've sent a little money your way over the years. I've read quite a few of yours. But if you had an 18-year-old man or woman who is about to go to one of the service academies, and you could put 3 to 5 books in their hands and say, read these, what would you recommend either that individual or that individual's father, uncle, or friend put in their hands to help give them some depth that they probably haven't gotten in their education to this point?
Well, obviously, I think that Thucydides is absolutely critical for political and military affairs, and I would have them read the history of the Peloponnesian War, maybe if not all at once, the key selections that would include, as I said, the Melian Dialogue or the Mytilenean Debates or the Stasis of Corcyra. I think it also it would be very good for them to read a large narrative history, something like Gibbon's Decline and Fall, or something like The Conquest of New Spain, the story of Cortez by Prescott, something along those lines, or even more recently, The Washing of the Spears about the Zulu War, some large continuous narrative that is not part of the latest historicist school. It just is great prose style, tells a story, good analysis, well documented, just that sort of enthuse them about what history can be like in the hands of a good craftsman. And then I think I would also like them to read some literature, and whether that would be Homer's Iliad or Sophocles' Antigone or Beowulf or Hamlet or Macbeth, something literary, so they can see that there are archetypes in the world, that characters that great artists will develop, and they have the same basic themes. And that reminds the student that they're not special, they're not new, that there wasn't an agony that somebody saw. Somebody saw certain characteristics in Oedipus. Somebody saw something in Juvenal's satires. So that they get this idea that their own lives are not at all unique. They're just same themes that appear in literature. So, and then finally, probably some philosophy, whether it would be Aristotle's Ethics. My favorite is his Politics. But it could be Plato's Republic. It could be Machiavelli's Art of War or The Prince, something like that, so they could see a thinker deal in the abstract. But I would like to have one of each genre, three or four of those.
One of my favorite books is more recent, much more recent than the classic books, but is the autobiography of General Grant, which I think is one of the great American books. And, of course, he had a tremendous editor. How could today's warfighter, and I appreciate your distinction between some of the warriors, especially Grant, and the professional bureaucrats who seem to occupy certain posts in the service during non-wartime, how can the warfighter and the active officer learn to write better, learn to put down on paper what his experience has been?
That's a good example. Grant was not, I mean, he was not a distinguished student. As you know, he graduated near the bottom of his class. He only had a bachelor's degree from West Point, Bachelor of Science, I should say, and he wrote at least the last third of that memoir where he was suffering from acute throat cancer and was in pain. The question is, how does somebody write like that? Obviously, he and Sherman, who wrote a similarly moving autobiography, had a natural talent. But I think also it's very important to see that in that age, a high school diploma, as far as literacy, vocabulary, style, syntax, grammar, was worth a bachelor's degree today. And a bachelor's degree in those days was equivalent to a PhD today. I mean that without exaggeration. So these are people who just studied things that we don't study anymore. I mean, if I take an undergraduate student and I look at their curriculum, to a Grant or to a Sherman, those would not even have been considered normal classes. They were taking geometry, ballistics, civics, forensics, oratory, rhetoric, Latin, philosophy, and that type of curriculum just doesn't exist for today. So first of all, they were much better educated. And then secondly, they were far more empirical. I think that part of the problem is today with cell phones, internet, television, we're a very passive culture where we don't really hone our skills of perception. Grant and Sherman were people who slept outside. They knew how to use a sextant. They noticed the phases of the moon. They knew what the summer solstice was. They knew what the winter equinox was. They knew they could tell whether a horse was spooked. They were physical people in a physical environment, and that meant that their powers of perception and their powers to record that perception were far different today than people who are plugged into an electronic society, a much more passive society, that ask a lot less of the reader and ask a lot less of the writer. And so I think that we're dealing in the 19th century as a whole with a very different type of person. As somebody who got a degree from West Point was highly educated in the 19th century in a way that we rarely see today. So I think I agree with you. Grant's memoirs are not only very vivid and analytical, but they're moving. So are Sherman's, and so are a lot of others. I've read most of them, even Jefferson Davis, whom I don't agree with. He had a power of perception. Albert Sidney Johnson's son finished a biography of his father. It was very good. So we're just talking about a very different generation and premium on the written word and the ability to convey thought and information through writing.
Do you believe that character is something that can be developed, or is character in the leadership part of that character something that is just given an opportunity to demonstrate itself? And whichever way you see it, are there things that you can do with a young man or woman between ages of 18 and 30 to help bring those best aspects of their character to the front, which will serve them well as a combat leader?
Well, you know, the Greeks said character is destiny. That's a line from Pindar. And character means a stamp. I mean, a literal stamp in Greek. The word just means to brand somebody. So in their way of thinking, the word was what you were born with. And I think that we all have individual characters that are unique and are a product of biology. But the better way to think of it is that within these sidelines, you have to work on your character. It means perhaps that some people it's going to be easier than for others. We know people who are naturally generous, or they're magnanimous, great-souled in the word of Aristotle. And then others have to work at it. But I think that all universities really need to stress character and give them situations. As you know, in the Naval Academy, I taught there a year as a Shiffrin professor in 2002 and 2003, and I thought the Naval Academy was very good in inculcating areas where students would learn classical traits that made one have character. What were they? They were pretty easy. They were consideration for the feelings of others, the willingness to take personal risk, self-sacrifice, the ability not to speak in public unless one could truly contribute something to the conversation and bring in a unique point of view, the assertion that nobody was going to ask somebody else to do something unless he was willing to do it himself. These are all things that are found in Aristotle's ethics, and they have sort of been imbued throughout Western civilization. That's what makes Western society such a more humane and polite area than what we see in most of the world today. So character's born into us, and some of us are going to have a harder furrow to plow because we're not endowed with natural elements of good character. But all of us can learn to be good people and to have good character if it's taught right. And I think the military does a pretty good job. I was just talking to about 8 lieutenant colonels and colonels last week at the Hoover Institution, and I met one of the directors of the Hoover, and he sat in and he was telling me, where do these people come from? They just seem, they're all different, but they seem to be operating on premises of politeness and character that we don't see in regular society. And as he put it to me, they remind me that they just walked out of the 1940s or the 1950s. He said they even looked different. But obviously the military is operating under premises that are in some ways antithetical to the trends of popular contemporary society today. And that's something that's very worrisome, because when you talk to somebody in the military, an officer especially, you get the impression that he belongs in a different age. That's dangerous for our age, and we mean that in a complimentary sense. So he's operating on 19th or early 20th century principles, but he's pre-modern almost, and he has to deal with a postmodern society of skepticism, cynicism, relativism. And I'm really very worried about that, because more and more our officer corps are almost dinosaurs, and they're aware of it, and society itself is aware of it as well. And there's that divide between officer and civilian, I don't think has ever been as great as it is today.
How much, in your perception, how much of that is driven by the when you're in combat, you have to be able to absolutely trust the man next to you or the person next to you. And in my experience in the civilian world, that is not necessarily how things work. Does that make for that kind of exceptionalism or throwback behavior?
I think it does. I think that in civilian life, in the modern industrial big government state, the very traits that make one successful, as I hinted at earlier, are getting along, mouthing a particular line, finding a superior that has influence and power, and accommodating to oneself. And then when a person's out in combat or in the military, in those situations that you outline, all of those traits are antithetical to survival or to winning or to victory. And so I think the military is ambiguous about this. They understand that for 90% of their time they're going to be in peace, and that they're going to naturally fall back into those habits of their civilian counterparts. But so far there's enough people in the military, I think, that realize they have their eye out for particular individuals that may be struggling in the peacetime military bureaucracy, but they have a hunch or they suspect that in times of real crisis in Anbar province or in the Hindu Kush, these are the type of people they need, and they want them around, and they make allowances for that. And I don't see that very often in the corporate or the university world.
One thing that has struck me recently, you know, we're talking about the experience that people have in college, is a couple things kind of paralleling. We've seen, now that the last excuse is gone with the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, ROTC returning to the Ivy Leagues, which has generally been seen as very hostile towards the military. And back in the 80s when I was in ROTC, I had some prior military people would come over to me and would say, wow, it's neat that you could walk around campus in your uniform, because back when I was in ROTC in the 70s, we only wore a uniform we had to. We switched out because it was so hostile, and you don't now. And I talked to some of the younger men and women coming out of ROTC, and it seems that there might have been a shift towards more tolerance over the last 15, 20 years towards the military. But have you seen a shift in attitude over the last 10, 20, 30 years towards a more positive attitude towards the military, or is it that was that just specific to my experience?
No. You're describing a well-known phenomenon that everybody realizes, that the further we get away from Vietnam, the attitude toward the military is improved. Part of it is its competency and its emphasis on education and leadership. I think that today when you see an officer, you don't anymore, if you're a PhD or an academic, it's very possible that that officer is better spoken, better educated than his civilian counterpart. That helps. And that's true even down all through the ranks. As you know, the military is more discriminatory than City College is today and who it wants in the military. Today's city colleges and state universities really want federal money, and they'll take anybody. And that's not true of the military. So that has helped a great deal. And I think most people admit that, accept that. I'm a little worried because I think that as ROTC returns to the so-called Ivy League, and they're discussing it right as we speak at Stanford this week, I think there's going to be an effort that these universities will actually encourage it, because they see now the military is sort of a nexus for social change in the ways that are more efficient, or they're more readily achievable than they are in the mess of democracy. So if you want a particular gender or class or race or whatever your particular agenda is, you can affect that change more quickly in an authoritarian system with a chain of command than you can fighting and haggling or having a plebiscite or a proposition. So I'm watching this Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and I think that there's a lot of people who feel in the gay community that now military service will be very attractive, because it will allow voicing of certain issues, or it will have a particular gender agenda that might be, in fact, fast-tracked in a way it can't in a civilian realm. I know that sounds politically incorrect, but I don't think the military's problem is going to be getting back onto the Ivy League campus. I think it's going to be that a lot of people in the Ivy League campus are going to see this new military as something that could go the way of the foundations or the universities or the arts or journalism or the media, that is an American institution that could become very, very progressive in a way that they think is quite desirable.
Well, that would be an interesting battle to have if it starts trending that way, because I think with the new media, you're going to get a lot more pushback than you might have had in the past. And Dr. Hansen, as we end up the show here, I'd like to give you a chance. I haven't picked up the book, but it's on my short list because I've really enjoyed the other things that you've put out there. But your latest book, The Father of Us All, War in History, Ancient and Modern, I noticed that on the cover is Charles de Steuben's classic painting of the Battle of Tours in 732 with Charles Martel at the center. What are you trying to get across with your latest book, and what could the reader expect to find there?
Well, they were essays, most of them previously published, but not all of them. And I was trying to argue, as we spoke about today, that whether it's radical Islam or whether it's a failed state or whether it's counterinsurgency or counterterrorism or whatever ism or ology, preemption, multilateralism, none of these concepts are new. All of them have precedence, and we can see them in a context of history if we just study them, and that's very valuable. Not only do we learn lessons to avoid the mistakes of the past, but we get a sense of moderation, humility, that we are not the first people to encounter a particular situation. I think right now our great danger in civilian military affairs is a sort of democratic hysteria. We all want to go to war. We all want the status quo in Iraq. We've all won. 73% of the people are all for it. George Bush is a saint. 2 years later, the search is going full blast. Nobody was for the war. George Bush is a monster. Iraq is hopeless. Then suddenly the surge, oh yeah, now it's a good war again. And we go back and forth. Democracies always do that, but in an electronic age, it's really good to ground people and say, oh, wait a minute. We don't need to go from one extreme to the other every 24-hour news cycle. Let's go back in the past and see what other people have done when they were in similar situations.
Well, Dr. Hansen, on behalf of Eagle One and myself, thank you very much for improvising, adapting, and overcoming with us today and spending 30 minutes this afternoon. It's been a real great show and a pleasure to have you on to talk about this topic.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, sir, and thank you very much for everybody that joined us live and contributed in the chat room. Hope everybody has a great Navy Day.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.